These days, many of us live a very public life. You go out for lunch, check into the pizza place on Foursquare, post a photo of your slice of pizza on Twitter, and then type a review for Yelp while you eat your pizza. Then you like your friend's comments, and they like your comments. And then you blog about the experience. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, forget all that stuff. We're going to go top secret and look at a line of work that requires an element of mystery. We'll speak with a retired FBI agent about cybercrime, identity theft, the history of the feds in Kansas City, and internet security. Then we're going to bring in two private investigators for the lowdown on what their work entails, from background checks to missing persons to cheating spouses. We'll hear how emerging technology helps and hinders the work they do. Join us on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. In popular lore, criminal and legal investigations are usually concluded within the hour. 2 hours and change at the movies, a few pages of a detective novel, a couple of episodes of Cops or First 48. But the actual non-scripted reality show of life as an investigator doesn't come with as many commercial breaks or as many punched-up dialogues. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Today on the program, we talk to a retired FBI special agent and a couple of real-life private investigators about the nuances of their work that are too hot for TV, but just right for radio. And joining us now is Jeff Lanza, author of Pistols to Press, Lessons in Communication from an FBI Agent and Spokesman. Welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the first question is, what's tougher, rounding up wise guys in a RICO case or addressing a room full of reporters?
Yeah, I always thought, as I became a spokesman for the FBI over the years of 18 years as a spokesman with the Bureau of my 20 as an agent, is it harder to keep criminals from running amok or keep the media from running amok? And I think it's down to the finish line there. I learned to handle the media pretty well before they handled me, and they have their techniques for getting information. But having a little bit of experience as a spokesman, I learned that you got to talk in sound bites for television. You got to learn how to say things concisely and give them the information that they need to the extent that you can, and then have a good relationship with reporters. And if you do all those things, you're probably going
to
be okay.
You ever talk in sound bites to criminals as well? We're looking at that right now. We'll get back to you with that. Does it mess their head up a little bit when you talk to them in sound bites?
Well, yeah. I mean, you got to be concise with them as well. They lose, they lose interest just like a viewer on a television show does.
Now, Jeff, you actually took a job at Xerox out of school, but all the while your eyes were on life as a G-man, so to speak. Tell us about that journey.
Well, I used to watch a show when I was 11 years old on network television on ABC on Sunday night. You had a choice between watching Ed Sullivan, Disney's Wonderful World of Color, or the show called The FBI, and I chose The FBI. It starred an actor named Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. Thought he was the coolest guy in the world, and I said, that's what I want to be when I grow up. And he was a man of justice and integrity, so I decided that was the job I wanted. Now, when I graduated from college, I wasn't qualified to be an agent. I went to grad school, and then I ended up getting a job from Xerox. Still wasn't qualified to be an agent, and when I worked for Xerox after a few years, I was in their computer division. I was doing computer systems analysis, and Xerox, I got tired of that life, and I decided I wanted to pursue my dream to become an agent. So I had that computer experience. That's what got me in the FBI.
And tell us the procedure where one ends up getting assigned to the FBI, getting accepted to the academy at Quantico. Tell us about that.
Well, it's actually a long process. You apply to the FBI, and if you meet the minimum requirements of age, education, and experience, then you can apply. And then if you get through the initial round of testing, you go through an interview process, you go through medical exams, you go through physical training, you take a polygraph test, then you go through 21 weeks of training at Quantico, Virginia, and then you're on probation for 2 years. And if you make it through all that, you're an agent for the rest of your career.
So once you made it through all that, there was a sort of nail-biting assignment situation when you were getting ready to be assigned as a special agent to the different regions of the United States where the FBI was concerned. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I was in the Bureau in my training in 1988. I sat next to a girl from New York City, the only place that you can actually pick where you wanted to go in the FBI of their 56 field offices was New York City, and be sure to be assigned there because they needed agents there. It's a high-cost area. The girl next to me was from New York. She wanted to go to New York. I had no desire to go to work as an agent in New York as my initial assignment. I got sent to Kansas City. Happy to go there. It was April Fool's Day when we got our orders. We all get called up in front of the class. We're handed an envelope. I opened mine. It said Kansas City. I was happy. She opened hers, and she thought for sure she was getting New York. She was assigned to New York. She reads the envelope. It said she'd be assigned to Little Rock. She was, she almost fainted. She comes down, sits next to me, and she says, "Where's Little Rock?" And I said, "I think it's outside of the New York metropolitan area." turns out it was an April Fool's joke, and they let go on for about an hour until they told her that she was assigned to New York after all.
So the FBI does have a sense of humor after all.
A little bit, yeah. That they know of, a little bit of a sense of humor.
You mentioned you were happy when you got assigned to Kansas City, but you didn't know a lot about the history of the FBI in Kansas City when you were assigned there.
Right.
Tell us about that steep learning curve.
Well, it actually happened very quickly. As I'm walking out the door in May 1988 to head off to Kansas City, one of my instructors, been an FBI agent for a long time, he says, You're going to Kansas City. He says, "You're going to love Kansas City." And I said, "Why?" And I thought he was going to say, "Well, he was going to say good people there, good Midwest values, and good food, barbecue." He says, "You're going to love Kansas City." I said, "Why?" He says, "They have some great organized crime in Kansas City." And I was pumped up. I'm pumping my fist. Like, that's a reason to be excited to work in a city. But if you're an FBI agent, it is. And when I got here, I wasn't working organized crime. I worked corruption cases. But I learned there was a lot of history in Kansas City. Of course, the Union Station massacre was the event that started the FBI on its development to become the agency that became today.
And there's actually a connection between you and the Union Station massacre.
Right.
Tell us about that.
In 1990, I got a call from FBI headquarters, someone doing research on historic badges. And they called me up right out of the blue, and they said, "You know, you have a very historic badge." I said, "What do you mean?" The guy that was in the Union Station massacre once carried the badge that you are now carrying. His name was Frank Smith. And I said, "Well, they did the research, and it just so happened, coincidentally, that I got assigned to this badge." So I have a little unique connection to the Union Station massacre, which is the beginning of the modern FBI.
They wouldn't necessarily discontinue that badge number. They just recycled?
Yeah, at that time, when agents retired, they gave back their badges. Now, when agents retire, you get the badge, and I still have that badge today.
So tell us about your career path as an FBI agent. Once you got into Kansas City, once you got the lay of the land, once you started investigating actual cases, what were your goals when you came in?
When I came in, I wanted to investigate the mob. I mean, that's simply what I wanted to do, and I always had an interest in the inner workings of the mob, and I saw the destruction they did to enterprises and how much money they drained from the economy. So when I got here, the mob cases were already taken care of for the most part. We had a mob in Kansas City, but it wasn't like it was back in the 70s. I got put on a corruption case, a corruption squad, and I was working against investigating cases of public officials that had taken bribes, kickbacks, and those sorts of things. And that was challenging for me, and I was interested in that. But along came an opportunity to be a spokesman for the FBI, and I thought I'd do that for a couple of years. I applied for the job, and I didn't think I would get the position, but they gave me an opportunity, and before I know it, I was on TV talking to radio stations and giving information about FBI cases, and I did that for 18 years.
So you were investigating bribes and kickbacks in Kansas City? That type of stuff exists here?
Surprise, surprise. Yeah. Well, we had so many members. The squad I was on had so many members of the city council had been indicted, and that was in Kansas City, Missouri at that time, and this was back in the early 1990s. Mayor Cleaver, who's, of course, now a U.S. congressman, was mayor at the time. He was asked by the Kansas City Star, said, "What's the?" He goes, "What do you got? What do you think about all these people being indicted on your council?" And he said, "Well, this could lead voters to think less of politicians." But then he went on to say, "But," and his quote in the Kansas City Star was, "But the overwhelming majority of the city council hasn't been indicted." And technically speaking, if he was talking about a 2/3 majority, he was correct. But we had a simple majority of the city council indicted. But that was the work of the squad that I was on at that time.
There's also some very interesting, funny stories when you talk about the lore of Kansas City. Tell us about the time you were investigating a bookmaking operation, and a guy calls up asking for a line on the Kansas City Chiefs.
Exactly. We busted a bookie in Kansas City, and as I'm sitting at the bookie's desk gathering his bookmaking materials and his records, marking things as evidence, the phone rings. It's a Sunday morning during football season. The veteran agent that was with me told me to answer it. I picked up the phone. The guy on the other line says, "Who's this?" I told him my real name. I said, "Jeff." He didn't say, "Jeff who?" He didn't say, "Jeff, where's my normal bookie?" He asked me the line on the Chiefs that day. So I looked down at the bookie's page, and I knew how to read the lines. I read the line to him. I go, "Chiefs are minus -3. Now, wait a minute. This is 1988. Chiefs are plus, probably plus 60 points at the time. So I say, "Chiefs are minus -3. So he gives me his bet, and I take down his bet and get his name. Next guy bets, and three or four more bets come in, and realize I'm playing the role of a bookie here, an impromptu undercover operation.
Did you guys end up busting those guys that called in to talk to you as well?
I don't think we went after the bettors. We actually, the bookie was the main target in that case.
You had already made your case then and were just kind of having fun there.
Yeah, although one guy called up and he wanted to make sure he got paid, and he gave us his first name, last name, address, and he spelled it out by letter to make sure he was going to get paid because he didn't know who I was. And we could have gone to his house if we wanted to.
That was kind of a surprise for him eventually.
A little bit of a surprise. In fact, one guy asked me, he said, "Jeff who?" About 45 minutes into this, he goes, "Jeff who?" And I just told him. I said, it wasn't undercover. So I go, "Jeff with the FBI." And I expected to hear a click. I didn't hear a click. I heard him cracking up. He's cracking up, "Jeff with the FBI." That's a funny one. "Jeff with the FBI." That's hilarious. "Hey, Jeff with the FBI, give me 50 on the Chiefs." He bet anyway, even though I told him who I was. It shows you how people can be so loose with information.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. As part of the hour, we're discussing criminal investigative work and the perceptions of investigators in and around the Kansas City area and in general. Our guest is Jeff Lanza, author of Pistols to Press, Lessons on Communication from an FBI Agent and Spokesman. Jeff, the FBI, as you describe it, and as we've seen in recent movies such as Public Enemy Number 1 and J. Edgar, it's images of men in really nice suits catching bad guys. That's the world you grew up in before you joined the Bureau.
Right.
What are your perceptions now after you retired?
Well, the suits aren't so nice. You know, at a government salary, we can't buy as nice a suit as I saw them wearing on TV. The FBI does a broad array of criminal investigations, and they've had to evolve a lot since 9/11. You know, when I joined the FBI, it was a lot like on TV, only, as you said in your introduction, the cases last a lot longer. You know, you take a show like CSI or Criminal Minds, you take out about 95% of the special techniques that they use, you expand it an hour into about a year, and then you have what the FBI does in these criminal investigations, because that's how long it takes sometimes. So that's the FBI that I joined. The FBI made another transition after 9/11. They went from an organization that's a law enforcement-based that also did intelligence gathering to an intelligence gathering organization that does law enforcement. So the focus is now on intelligence and, of course, preventing anything that approaches or any type of terrorist act in the United States, and that's the main goal of the FBI right now.
So it's more about building a case via domestic surveillance rather than actually going out and doing busts?
Yeah. Well, it's not as much a surveillance. It encompasses really everything. Part of it might be surveillance, but it's about prevention. You know, you can't prevent a bank robbery, you know, unless you get an informant says it's going to happen. Bank robbery is going to happen. You go out and bust the guy who robbed the bank, hopefully. But you can. The theory is you can prevent a terrorist act. A lot has to go into the planning. And if you can get your finger on the pulse and find tripwires that alert people, the FBI and law enforcement agencies, when something's going to happen, hopefully, as we've seen played out recently, you're going to prevent it before it happens. And that's the goal of the FBI now.
So in other words, the tenor of the times, based on the investigation that the FBI is doing now, is more preemptive. More proactive rather than reacting to a crime that has already taken place and investigating that crime.
That's correct. And in fact, there was one high-level official in the FBI that said shortly after 9/11, if we get attacked again, the FBI is out of business. And so the goal was we're not going to let that happen. And so we had to restructure how we do investigations and focus more on intelligence than just responding to a crime after it occurred.
So you got out of white-collar crime, and most of the mafia cases were closed or solved, the high-profile ones anyway, or petering out during the early to mid-90s when you were in your career in the FBI in earnest. So tell us how you came to essentially being a special agent in charge of handling the press.
Well, you know, I thought I was going to do that job for just a couple of years, move on to something else, and I started to like it, and I started to build relationships with reporters, people like Dan Verbeck, who works at the station, who worked at a different station at that time. But as you build relationships with people, you begin to like doing the work and meeting them on a regular basis. We had so many events in Kansas City that happened during that time. We had babies kidnapped from hospitals. We had fetus kidnappings. We had the Courtney drug dilution case. We had a New Year's Eve 1999 bank robbery with hostages. All those things, when you show up and you talk to the media, you start to build relationships and friends with the press, become friends with the press themselves, you start to like the job. And I really enjoyed that part of my responsibility with the Bureau.
Now, information is important in any investigation. You find yourself on the other side of the mic talking to the press. How can the press help or hinder an investigation? And how do you implement that control factor that you talk about in your book, controlling the pace of information?
Well, controlling the press is very important because they can put out information that would hinder a criminal investigation, information that we have that maybe they've obtained, and we want them to hold that because it could. We don't want the bad guys to know that yet. So that's where the relationships come in, and you want to make sure, you know, no reporter wants to hold information because they want to beat their competition. They want to get a story out first. Once you have those relationships, then you can ask them to hold something for a time. And then, of course, you need them. You need the press, absolutely. A lot of people in the FBI used to say, why do we have to tell the press anything? Well, you need them, don't you? And there's a baby kidnapped. You need them to report that information. When there's a child is missing, you need the media to let people know what kind of car was used in that abduction. And that's how we solve cases. So you can't have it both ways. You got to work with the press because they help you as well.
So sometimes you use the press, though. When you need, for instance, in a kidnapping, you use the press to get that information out. You put the picture out. You give a sort of description of the abducted.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, almost in any criminal case, when you're looking for someone, a fugitive or someone that's been abducted, you use the press, absolutely. But it works both ways. The press uses you to get information. They have stories out of it, too. You know, you can go out and take every agent in the FBI office and go interview, you know, 10 people each, and you're not going to reach anywhere near the number of people you could with just putting one report out to the media and having them put that out over their airways.
Now, you said you learned how to monitor conversations for what you call an inappropriate response. Have you monitored this conversation for inappropriate responses? What is an inappropriate response, Jeff?
An inappropriate response. Well, you know, in terms of talking, talking to the media, an inappropriate response would be something, for example, when you're giving out too much information or going on. And I tell this when I talk to media people about media relations. You know, if you take 30 seconds to answer a reporter's question, I can guarantee you in television, for taped television, that's not going to air in its entirety. They're going to cut it up and it's going to look like it's taken out of context. So you got to learn how to talk in sound bites. So a more appropriate answer to a question would be to give a sound bite. You can give all the backup information you want, but you got to talk in a sound bite mentality because that's what they're going to use. Got about 8 seconds.
So how do you train your voice and train your thoughts to talk in sound bites?
Well, you try to capture the gist of the information that they want, and you try to figure out how to say it in about 8 seconds, and that captures the key information. And believe me, 8 seconds is not – people think, well, that's a horribly long, horribly short time. How are you going to do that? When you think about the countdown to a you know, the old Apollo days when the spacecrafts are taking off, 10, 9, 8, 7, you have a lot of time. You know, 10 seconds, 8 seconds even is still a lot of time. So you figure out what you want to say and figure out how to say it in that amount of time.
5 seconds, for instance, between this conversation right now is an eternity.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
You said you had a fear of being handled by the press. How did that work? How did that fear work? How did you harness that fear?
Right. Well, I had the same fears coming into the media, and I was thrown right into the fire. You know, I didn't get any training to be a spokesman. The FBI said, oh, one day you're a spokesman, and now they give a lot more training. But I had the same fears that people have today of the press. You're going to be taken out of context. You're going to say something that you didn't mean to say. You're going to sound, you know, you're just going to sound stupid on the air. And so I had the same fears. And the way you get around that, the way you harness those fears to make you a better speaker is to, again, talk in sound bites, prepare, think about what you're going to say, what you're not going to say, and then have the relationships with the reporter. So if you're doing a taped interview, you have a good relationship with a reporter, and you could say something, and you say, you know, I didn't really say that the right way. I'd like to say it again. Or I didn't say, I shouldn't have given that information out. And if you have a good relationship, a lot of times they're not going to use that.
In criminal investigations, many feds have said they've learned to think as criminals think. Have you ever put yourself inside the mind of a really good beat reporter or investigative reporter and learned to think as they thought and tailor your answers based on that?
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many different reporters in Kansas City, and you know the newspaper reporters have a little bit more of a tilt towards getting much more detail. Television reporters are looking for the soundbite, radio kind of soundbite, a little more detail. So you put your head inside of that. What is a reporter looking for? What are they trying to do? Are they just doing a story here where they're going to go home and have dinner with their family tonight? And that's one kind of reporter. And the one that's going to be here 10 years from now. Then you have the other kind of reporter that graduated from MU that's going to come to Kansas City after they've been in St. Joe, and then they're going to go to Chicago. Then they're going to New York and think they're going to be on the host of the Today Show. That's a different type of reporter. If you put yourself inside their mind, they're looking to make a story. They're looking to get some kind of splash. And if you're not careful with that kind of reporter, you make it taken out of context or misquoted, because they're looking to just get something that's going to get them noticed.
Jeff, can you read that in a person?
I think you can tell, because I don't know if you can read it as much as just asking them some questions. Hey, where are you from? And a lot of them, you know, there's the reporters that have been at TV stations here for years, and you know they're not to do anything. They're going to hurt you. Then you have somebody coming out of school, and you kind of sense, you know, that maybe they're on their way to a bigger places or want to be, and that's the one you got to watch out for. Not all the time, but just you got to know that.
That's the one that's going to bite you.
Potentially.
Those ones coming out of MU, they're going to bite you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Tell us about the memorable experiences you had with Connie Chung and Larry King. Those are two of the national personalities that you work with. Yeah. With the FBI. Tell us about those.
Well, the Connie Chung case was an interesting one. I was interviewed by her one time on her show when she had a show on CNN. And the show was actually about some hate letters that have been sent to some churches here in town. Well, when we went on the show, I was with a minister that had received one of these hate letters. Her preamble to the interview embellished everything. It took a lot of things out of context, that there had been racial tensions in Kansas City that were all-time high. And so the minister corrected her and said nothing could be further from the truth. And then there was that silence that you talked about. This is a live television interview. It's about 3 seconds of silence on national TV. It's an eternity. Connie didn't know what to do. She comes back to me, asked me a question. I corrected her about what she had said, and there's just more silence. You know, about 2 weeks later, her show is discontinued, and Ted Turner, the head of CNN, is interviewed in the New York Times, and he said something way out of context, what I thought was out of context for him to say. He said her show was terrible, and our interview was terrible. I thought he might have been watching his show that night. So if there's two cases in my career I'm most proud of, the baby kidnapping in Kansas KU Med Center, we got the baby back, and the interview that got Connie Chung fired, that was a very memorable experience
for me. You
froze
Connie Chung. What about Larry King?
Well, Larry King, you know, I never thought I'd be interviewed by Larry King. I got to be interviewed by him, and I thought, gee, he's been interviewing people for years, for decades, maybe even centuries. He's going to be the best interviewer, and how am I preparing for Larry King? First question out of the box, I go on live with Larry King. He says, Agent Lanza, is this an FBI matter? Thinking, well, no, Larry, 2 million people are watching. I'm here in the studio. You got me all wired up because the FBI has nothing to do with the case at all. That's what I felt like saying to him. He actually throws softballs at you, not a tough questioner at all.
Why didn't you hit him back with that sardonic response to wake him up a little bit?
Yeah, well, it was a serious case, and we had and I didn't want to try to be, sarcastic and in that type of vein.
Speaking of which, what is the biggest misconception among members of the press, or maybe even among the general public, about the investigative process of the FBI and the investigative process in general?
I think a lot of the public and also the media believe, and I've heard this so many times from people, is that when the FBI shows up on the scene, they just take over the case. And, you know, there's a lot of joint jurisdiction between FBI, local, state authorities, different agencies. And the FBI doesn't come in and take over anything. They work with local authorities. So the conception is, or the perception, I should say, is that, you know, agents come in like in the movie Die Hard, when an agent comes in and he's talking to a police officer. Police officer says, I'm in charge here. And the agent lights a cigarette and says, not anymore. You're not in charge. You know, it doesn't happen that way.
It doesn't happen. That's never happened.
No, I didn't say never. When I was with the Bureau, here, at least here in Kansas City, it didn't happen that way. Now, there are probably times under Hoover and where that did happen, and maybe even in other cities to some extent recently. But the FBI didn't work that way in Kansas City.
It's interesting that you mentioned Hoover. He's been in the news a lot lately because of the movie. You actually came in after that tumultuous period when the Bureau had been realigned, reconfigured to not only more modern standards, but more transparent standards. How is it looking today that you're out?
Well, I think the Bureau had changed, like we talked earlier, the Bureau changed quite a bit after 9/11. And, you know, you can't be totally transparent, but you also can't have a bunch of secret files. And according to what we know about Hoover, and it's well documented that he did do, there were some abuses of power, but you can't have that today. And you shouldn't have had it back then either. And I think the FBI has changed a lot, and there's a lot more oversight because of the abuses back in the Hoover age.
You said in your book, Jeff Lanza, quoting one of Roosevelt's most famous quotes, "No one cares how much you know until they know how much you care." Right. What does that mean to you?
That's the role of empathy in any communication. And as a spokesman, I always try to use empathy, especially when tragic situations occurred. People are more likely to hear what you have to say, to listen to your communication. And when you use empathy, I think they realize that you care. And it humanizes you as an organization. Also, you're not some agency that's investigating another murder case, another kidnapping case. You're someone who cares about what happened to the victims, and they're more likely to listen and understand what you have to say. And that's the role of empathy in communication.
Is that also the role of empathy in investigations?
Absolutely. And there's a certain technique for interviewing people, too, both victims and perpetrators of crimes, to help get information. And empathy plays a big role in that, too. It humanizes you, and this humanizing creates better interaction and communication.
Our guest is Jeff Lanza, author of Pistols to Press, Lessons on Communication from an FBI Agent and Spokesman. Mr. Lanza will be speaking at the Plaza branch of the KC Public Library January 12th. At 6:30 in the evening. The event is free and open to the public. Mr. Lanza, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And we're going to pause for a quick break, and we're going to still be on the case when we return to talk to two local private eyes who are going to crack the lid wide open on the real world of private investigators. They may or may not be wearing trench coats. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We've been talking about perceptions, real and imagined, with investigations, and the case isn't closed yet. Our guests in this part of the hour are Roy Orth, owner of R. Orth & Associates, and Douglas Pearson, owner of Act Now Investigation. They are both private investigators. Welcome to Central Standard, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Now, Roy, what would you say is the biggest myth about the work that you do? The biggest myth?
You go back to the Magnum PI idea and to think that private investigators can work around the police and don't really have any rules that they have to follow. Not true.
And you know that as an ex-police officer and sergeant?
Yes, correct.
How about you, Doug?
Certainly the expectations of a family member that would expect quote-unquote magic, you know, from what their spouse is doing or what the particular case entails. Misconception of expectations.
So they're looking for you to go in as a cat burglar and get the combination to a safe and have the information for them within 20 minutes.
Like I can have a video camera in a motel room. It just doesn't work that way.
Right. But you do specialize, Doug, in infidelity and domestic issues. What would you say is the biggest misconception about the work you can do beyond setting up a video camera in a motel room?
Certainly the background investigation of a particular individual that a spouse is associating with, that can have a major impact on the psychological effects of the relationship. You know, is the person married? You know, what does that exactly entail? Interacting with the combination of that and surveillance, and certainly the modern technology of GPS trackers and the old box that sits on your desk called the computer.
The old box that sits on your desk. Before we get more into the thick of the discussion, what are the things we see on TV and in the movies, Roy, that actually never happen? I mean, never, with private investigators. It never happens in real life, but we see it all the time on TV.
The private investigator having access to official government sources. One of my favorites is where the private investigator goes into the coroner's office and is able to draw full coroner's reports simply for the asking. Just doesn't quite work like that.
We just had a Jeff Lyons on from the FBI. He retired from the FBI in 2008. He said no one comes to an investigation or crime scene with a cigarette, puffs it, and says, "I'm in charge now."
Yeah,
sort of like that.
Yeah, sort of like that.
So you've never been shot at, Doug, and someone met you in an alley later that day and told you, "You're getting too close. Back off." That never happened?
Exactly. I'm asked a lot if I carry a firearm, and absolutely not. If it's getting to that situation, they need to call law enforcement.
When, Roy, did you decide to be a PI? You became a self-employed PI after a career in law enforcement as a detective sergeant for the KCPD. What made you decide to become self-employed as an investigator after years with the department?
I took about a year off and found that the life of leisure wasn't really for me. I had a whole group of the attorneys who I actually used to work across the aisle from who approached me and asked me if I would start doing investigations for them. Here in the last 2 years, I've been asked and have started accepting criminal defense work. We've worked four homicides this year. So it's more in line with the stereotypical work that most people think about from a private investigator.
So for you, it started as sort of a freelance investigative work where people came and asked for your expertise from being a police officer. And then you said, "Hey, I can actually do this on my own for a living." Is that what happened?
Yes, that's correct. And it's primarily attorneys. I don't do much work for individuals. It's generally law firms. And I have been contracted on several occasions to actually do work for Jackson County now.
What's different about the experience, Roy, as a private contractor now? Do you get ribbed like Jake in Chinatown, or is the relationship with current officers and current law enforcement officials a little bit more collegial than what we see or what we notice?
Well, it's interesting. Up until a couple of years ago in the state of Missouri, you did not have to be licensed to be a private investigator. It was not uncommon to find a used car dealer / notary public / private investigator. And I think a lot of the jokes came from that.
Right.
Now, the state of Missouri regulates private investigations, as I think Kansas does or always has for quite some time.
Absolutely, through the KBI of the Attorney General's office in Topeka.
And you both have been in this for a while. So has the regulation of issuing licenses for private investigators sort of thinned out the slash guys? He's talking about the guys that hand you a business card and you turn it over. I do this too, by the way.
I definitely think – I'm agreeing with Roy on that. I definitely think in the state of Missouri it's increased the professionalism and forced people to get like insurance verification and various other financial means to make it a more of a professional and give our industry a lot more credibility.
Is there ever a sense, Roy, when you're working with former colleagues in the department that you're interfering with an investigation?
No, and I'm very careful to make sure that that doesn't happen. There's a very fine line between private investigations and the police department. One of the things that I was asked in preparation for this show was a little history on private investigations. And officially, it started about 1833 in France with a bit of a character who was a retired military man. He was a convicted criminal and a privateer. And he found that doing investigations for private folks, not under the close control of the government, as most official police departments were at that time, was advantageous to his clients. So going along with that thought, there's a lot that private investigators actually can do and have access to that as a police officer I did not have access to.
And that French guy's name wasn't Inspector Crusoe, was it?
No, but quite Sir Conan Doyle utilized that character when he came up with Sherlock Holmes. So that all started back then.
It all starts with the truth, and then it gets spun out into popular myth. Doug, Act Now is the name of your operation. You specialize in infidelity and domestic issues. Once a suspicion arises, does Act Now go without saying?
Certainly, that was definitely something I wanted to get in front of people and say, you know, yeah, let's get on this right now and see what happens.
Roy Orth and Doug Pearson are both private investigators here on Central Standard, telling us the real deal, debunking myths about private investigators. We've been talking about Inspector Crusoe and relationship with the police department, cigarettes and all that type of thing that's in the popular myth and culture. Kansas City, have you always wondered about the work of PIs? Have you had to march into one of their offices and put them on the case? If so, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up on Facebook or tweet us at KCURCST. And if you have questions for the private investigators that are here live in the studio today, hit us up. What does it take to be a great private investigator, Roy? Have you learned that in your years after the police department?
That's a great question, and it's an evolving question. I think the real secret is to never think you know it all. Always know there's more to learn, and every situation is different. Regardless of how serious someone takes it for themselves, to them, it's the most important thing in the world.
And Doug, you've been at this for more than two decades. How has the discipline evolved?
Well, I definitely think having deductive reasoning and assuming that the facts, starting an investigation with assuming that the facts are not right in front of you, and to be able to create those. I kind of, an analogy would be, I tell my clients that an investigation is like climbing a tree, where you sit on a branch for a little bit. It might get a little weak. You might have to transfer to another branch, go up, down. It's very up and down like that, versus climbing a ladder that's very 1, 2, 3, 4. So that's what makes it intriguing, the fact that you have to constantly adjust and shift with whatever the circumstances and the information are that is in front of you.
Is this still a male-dominated field? Are you seeing more women coming into private investigating work?
There are a lot of women in the field now, very, very competent investigators.
And has that been more apparent over the years, a growth of female private investigators?
I think there's certain opportunities that women actually can benefit in a certain situation more than a man, in terms of if a female goes to a door, the perception is different of what the threat is and what the expectation is and what the information is that you're willing to disclose.
With domestic abuse, and certainly with divorce and child custody cases, do you find enlisting a female subcontractor or enlisting some staff at your office, a female staff member, do you find that more advantageous?
I actually have a female on surveillance right now.
Right now, as you speak?
As I'm doing this interview, yes.
She's circling the studio, or she's somewhere else?
Hopefully over on the Kansas side.
Roy, who are some of the more memorable names in the history of private investigating, other than that French guy that you mentioned that was the inspiration for Sherlock Holmes, that helped shape your work?
Oh, absolutely. Probably number one would have to be Pinkerton. And that goes back to about 1850, where Pinkerton and his associates were able to uncover a plot against then-President-elect Abraham Lincoln. And from that bit of investigative work, his organization grew until at one point, after the Civil War, there were actually more Pinkerton agents carrying Pinkerton badges in the state of Ohio than there were military personnel, and they were actually banned from the state because there was a fear that they might take it over.
They also put him on Jesse James, the Pinkerton
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid were investigated by Pinkertons. The Dalton Gang, they did a lot of railroad work.
And it eventually got a little dubious when they started getting involved in labor strikes and things of that nature.
Unfortunately, that's true. We mentioned a little earlier that private investigators aren't bound by the same set of laws and restrictions that law enforcement are. So private enterprise sorted that out pretty quickly and put them to work on labor relations.
And Doug, you're smiling like a Cheshire cat. Do you set your own line? Do you set your own ethical boundaries as a private investigator?
Oh, sure. I kind of laughed during our our pre-interview discussion about the fact that you were talking about off the record. Well, you know, with investigators, I love that. There's really not an off the record like the media perceives that to be. So when people say that, I'm like, okay, no problem. It's off the record until I make it my notes.
Right,
you know?
Right. You put it right in your notes and say, but you said it was off the record. I'm a private investigator. Sorry.
Exactly.
So there is no distinction. There is no, hey, this is on deep background.
Right.
You don't go by those rules.
Well, you know, I mean, you need to be professional, and a lot of it is just common sense. If it's against the law or it's illegal, you don't do it. And it's pretty much, if you think like a logical person would, a normal citizen that tries to do the right thing, you'll be fine. I've never had any issues with that.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Roy Orth and Douglas Pearson are both private investigators here debunking the myths of PIs and also telling us what private investigators actually do. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. If you've ever had to march into one of the private investigators' office and put them on the case, if you want to debunk myths about PIs, call in and join the conversation. Also hit us up on Facebook at KCURCST is our Twitter handle. Roy, you wanted to say something?
Yes. One of the things that Doug said sparked something. A question that I'm often asked and an assignment I'm often asked to do is to locate people that have dropped out of people's lives. A case that I did about 6 months ago involved a 23-year-old girl here in Kansas City who had lost her father about 18 years earlier. That brings up all kinds of ethical and moral questions. As an adult, we all have the right to disappear. I was able to find the father in Florida. It took me about a week. The father didn't want to be contacted. I did not charge the girl because I wasn't able to give her ethically and morally the location of her dad, so she still doesn't know, and I protected his privacy. I'm assuming, Doug, you have the same set of rules?
Oh, sure. I mean, I do a lot of missing persons kinds of work as well, and you need to make sure I tell them that this has got to be a win-win combination for both the client and the recipient on the other side. So certainly understanding the emotional aspect of father-son or siblings, I mean, that can get very emotional.
You have the right not to want to be found. That's an interesting concept, especially when you talk about the advances of technology and how they've changed private investigating work. How have they changed, Doug, private investigating work?
I'm not sure what you're after there.
I'm after the work that you do in databases being different, the work that you do with internet searches, the work that you do with searching for people electronically. That's certainly changed the game in terms of research.
Oh, absolutely. The you know, when I first got into this business, you would run from county to county courthouse to county courthouse, and it would take you 4 or 5 hours from Johnson County to Wyandotte to Jackson County. You know, well, maybe I needed to do something in Cass, and that would take all day. Now you spend a half hour, 45 minutes in your office accomplishing what used to take you 4 to 5 hours. So it's all very compact in the information that you get into certain databases.
And Roy, you've seen that evolution happen as a member of the police department where you're getting information out of criminal databases, cross-references, cross-checks in electronic files and searches.
That's correct. And in the last 10 years, information available to law enforcement is very tightly controlled through federal, state, and local agencies. As a private investigator, a lot of the information that we work off of comes from what's called credit header information. Anybody that rents an apartment, buys a car, applies for insurance, all those applications go into a Big Brother database.
Is that what they call it? A Big Brother database?
That's what I call it. I'm obviously a child of the 60s.
Right.
That information, if you're qualified and have authorization to access it, is available to one degree or to another, and it's not readily available to law enforcement.
But it's available to private citizens.
No, private investigators. You have to be licensed.
How is it not available to law enforcement, but more readily available to private investigators?
Law enforcement has budgetary constraints.
Well, there you go.
There you have it.
There you go. There you go. It's about the money. Joe, welcome to Central Standard, calling in from Leawood. Hello.
Hello. This is Joe.
Hey.
Yes.
How are you?
Well, great. It's a wonderful show today.
Thank you.
I'm really enjoying the guest, and I wanted to comment on the fact that I had occasion to use a private eye about 10 or 12 years ago on a matter of estate, of selling my father's estate. It was something I needed to find out, and this was recommended to me by a lawyer that I use a private eye.
Let me stop you for a second.
Sure.
I recognize your syrupy voice. Were you on a radio show yesterday?
I was on a local radio show yesterday called Central Standard.
Wow. That's very interesting. How did you use the private investigator? How would you use Doug to find out information about probate stuff? You were involved in a case about your inheritance on your farm.
Right. Well, I needed someone to get photographs, and I needed someone who would be totally unrecognizable as a member of the family. But your wonderful guests were talking about the use, how the field has a great many female investigators, and I just wanted to say that I was under the stereotype impression that I would be working with a man, and I was surprised to see that I was working with a woman. But as it turned out, she was the very best choice. A man would not have been able to get into this place I needed them to go, and would not have been able to be a credible person. I needed a woman investigator.
Thank you for your contribution to the conversation, Joe. Now, occasionally, fellas, you'll have someone that wants a particular means to an end, just like your case, Roy, where the daughter wanted her father to be found. The father didn't necessarily want to be found. Has anybody ever asked you, Doug or Roy, to do espionage, Pink Panther type work to sort of push further their aim in a case that they were either a plaintiff or a defendant in?
Yeah, I can answer. The answer is yes.
Yes.
And it happens for me on a pretty regular basis, especially in criminal investigations.
Tell us about some of those instances.
In one case, it was a white-collar crime situation, and I was doing some work for a corporation client, and they asked me to covertly bug an office. And they wanted both audio and video because they suspected that the employee was involved in some espionage-type work. I declined to do that. I viewed that as an invasion of the person's privacy and didn't do it, although there are an unbelievable amount of equipment out there available to do that sort of thing with.
The Pelicanos case out in California with investigating the lives of celebrities and wiretapping accountants and lawyers and things of that nature, and also what we've seen with the Rupert Murdoch investigations out in the UK, the use of private investigators to get celebrity information. There's a line that to be drawn here, Doug?
Oh, absolutely. I deal with that on a domestic level as well, you know, making sure that it's clear to a particular spouse that it's not a good idea to put a recorder in your husband's car. I mean, you know, they need to know the legalities of that and the risks that they're taking if they choose to do that. So I want to make that clear, when, as well as their office or any other place that they might be associating with.
Is it not ethical, or is it not also not legal?
Both.
Both.
Ken wants to know, what's the most realistic TV show on PIs that either one of you have seen? What comes closest?
Let's see. We get every investigation over in an hour, and we run every 10 minutes. We run 2 minutes of commercials, so we get everything done in 45 minutes. I'm not a big investigator TV watcher.
You don't have much time to watch
TV. I do have Rockford Files as my ringtone for my phone, so You know, that's energizing.
Is that your most realistic, or is that your most inspiration? Because it's so cool.
That's my inspiration.
Okay. What about you, Roy? Is there anything that comes close?
Well, there's a joke I always say. They're training films. Something that comes close. I think some of the old Frank Sinatra shows were probably as realistic as it gets in the for the 40s and 50s. I think the
have any of you guys ever been consulted for programming or television shows on what actually happens? Has anyone contacted you about your experience?
I actually was contacted by one of the TV stations regarding the baby Lisa Irwin case, and that never worked out logistically, but that was really not my area to pursue. But I was, you know, I mean, so periodically we'll get inquiries about particular things. So,
are you glad you didn't participate in that?
Yes. Yes.
What does the future, Roy and Doug, look like for current and future investigators? What types of casework growth areas do you see in investigations today? The FBI agent who was on, the former FBI agent who was on earlier, mentioned cybercrime and identity theft as two hot button issues, surveillance, things of that nature. What do you see?
Well, I cybercrime's absolutely. Use of technology, one of the things that we're doing now, a recent Missouri Supreme Court case for plaintiff lawsuit information. Puts the responsibility of investigating jurors back on the plaintiff's side. So something that's I've been doing for the last year is doing very, very speedy background investigations on potential jurors for my lawyer clients. So that's one big area.
Briefly, Doug, what do you see?
More and more technical-driven, things that associate with credit cards, anything that requires a button is more and more becoming more popular, and it's the the cell phone enhances the recording of cell phone calls that enhances that whole aspect. I mean, it really varies.
So not the buttons on trench coats, but the buttons you hit on computers.
Exactly.
We've been discussing past, present, and future of the work of Private Eyes with Roy Orth, owner and founder of R. Orth & Associates, and Douglas Pearson, owner of Act Now. They're both private investigations firms. They're both real private investigators, both on the case and both dispelling the myths through their daily work. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us on Central Standard.
Thank you.
And tune in tomorrow for the Walt Bodine Show with the Movie Critics. Our show is produced today by Danny Alexander. Our producer is Andrea Salenzi. Our multimedia producer is Tamika Weatherspoon. Our executive producer is Bill Anderson. Suzanne Hogan has been our fill-in announcer this week, and Emily Mutert manages our website. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney, and the outro you're hearing right now is by The Will Knots. The Will Knots. Up to Date is next with a look at 50 years of manned spaceflight. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.